It's now 8 o'clock. So I can begin this morning's Dhamma talk. We're getting towards the, or in the middle of our 9-day retreat now. Time goes very fast if you watch the clock. But sometimes in meditation you don't watch the clock at all. You just enjoy this moment and time can go very slowly, but very beautifully and very perfectly. And of course, that's always the best thing to do. And so we try never to think how much time has gone past, never to think how much time is left. It's just how much time do you have now? It's a strange thing that if you come into things like the present moment, to really allow the mind to settle in the now, it's as if there's no time at all. It's as if that you're squashed, the past has disappeared, the future is not here. You've got this one tiny moment of time. It's not even a second long, it's just now. But that present moment appears to be infinite. It doesn't have any measure to it. And it gives you a great sense of freedom. It's weird. If you ask a person, can you put your mind in the prison of the now? No past, no future, just in this jail cell of the present moment. That's one way of looking at it, one way of perceiving it. But in reality, it feels like you've got all the time in the world. It's that old mathematical contradiction that zero is just so close to infinity. That nothing is without time, is without space, is without measurement. It is a measurement which causes us much of the problems. But nevertheless, today I did give a bit of a talk yesterday about the five hindrances. And of course it's a sixth hindrance, my mask. That's only a joke, okay. So I usually wear it as much as possible. But anyway, those five hindrances, but you can understand sometimes the mask, it just means you cannot hear properly what I say. Sometimes, first of all, you can't breathe as comfortably as with the mask off. Sometimes it can be a bit of an irritation, but if you notice, you get used to it after a while, and it doesn't feel to be an irritation at all. And that's like some of the hindrances which we have. Sometimes we get used to it, we think, oh, it's not much of a hindrance at all. And it's just the same as everybody else. So to actually really know the hindrances and to know exactly, you know, what they are and where they come from and where they fit in the good old Eightfold Path. I did mention that that is the prerequisite before you do Satipatthana practice. Restrained the five hindrances. And I never mentioned yesterday that even though that, you know, was obvious when I started reading the suttas in Pali, that the first hindrance was a synonym for Lokeyabhija, or Lokeyabhija was a synonym for the first hindrance. But also Dhammanasa, the second word in the Satipatthana Sutta, was also in two suttas was a synonym for the second hindrance. You know, which is the ill will. But more than that, I remember just when you really got into the study, that if you look at the two Satipatthana Suttas, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta in the Digha Nikaya and the ordinary Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, in both of their commentaries, the commentaries are the explanations. And the explanations has said specifically the Vinaya Loke Abhija Dhammanasang, Loke Abhija Dhammanasang, refers to the first two hindrances of the five hindrances, and it is just to the idiom of Pali that if you mention the first two of a well-known group, then it includes all the others. So even the people who wrote the commentaries to both Satipatthana Suttas confirmed that that means having restrained, limited, trained so the five hindrances are not strong. That's what you have to do before you embark on the Satipatthana practice. So how do you do that? And I did mention, if you do achieve a jhana experience, or even nimitta experiences, strong nimitta experiences, you do find those five hindrances are just gone for a long time. I mean, they really are gone. To do Satipatthana, they just have to be weakened a lot. Otherwise, you know, you do the mindfulness of the body. Are you really aware of the body? Or are you just in denial of some things? You know, so often, if a person's got something which they're afraid of, say a cancer or a tumour, oh, it's not cancer, it's not a tumour, because that's fearful. And because of that, you'll be in denial to it. It's natural. And there's so many other things in life, because they are scary to you, we always say, no, no, it's not really happening. And I do recall, many years ago, in the good old Armadale group, there was a lady who would come to do some meditation, and then one day I was told that she had a problem, a big problem, a huge problem. It wasn't a cancer. What was happening was that the teachers at school had found out her two children were being sexually abused by her husband. And it was the first time she even suspected that. But the teachers at school, you know, saw the telltale signs and interviewed the children, and it was true. And their father, her husband, was put in jail. And of course the marriage ended. She moved from Perth back to UK. But the interesting part, she felt guilt at first. A mother's love for her child was always wanting to protect them. How come she could not see that? The teachers could see it, but the mother couldn't. You can understand very simply why. And that was because it was such a terrible thing to see. Such a disastrous thing. That before that day, she loved her husband. And now she realized, you know, what the husband was doing when she wasn't around. And of course, that love disappeared. But not only that, you know, the marriage was over a huge group of problems. But the first problem of guilt, how come you can't see that? Because admitting it, seeing it was so gross, it was blocked out of her perception. That hindrance of negativity. You can't see, you really can't see what is so difficult to see and what is just so horrendous to deal with. It's this nature of the mind. What you perceive, what you see, what you hear, what you smell, taste and touch is filtered. So you usually only see what you want to see, or you don't see what you don't want to see. And that type of filtering is obviously going to block wisdom in all areas. That is an extreme example. But one lovely thing there, because, you know, she was going to our Armadale group years ago, week after week, she learned so much wisdom, and she learned about kindness, and enough to forgive her now ex-husband. And I remember that she came to see me once, and she wasn't really upset, but she was just irritated, because according to the law in Western Australia, or in Australia I think, that if such a thing happens, the mother has to get counselling. And when she told her shrink, that, you know, her counsellor, that she'd forgiven her ex-husband, she didn't want to see him again or punish him again, but, you know, she didn't have any anger to him. Then the counsellor said, oh, she must be in denial. She said, no, I'm not in denial. I know what he did. And that's terrible what he did to my kids, but I don't want to give him any extra pain. And they said, you're not really admitting what happened. Like, yeah, I am admitting what happened. This is what happened, that's what happened. So in the end, she asked me, said, look, you're my teacher. Can you please write a letter to the psychiatrist? Say she's a Buddhist. And this is how Buddhists think. She has totally admitted what has happened. She's not in denial, but she doesn't want to add, you know, to a very painful situation with more pain. And that's it. So I often notice that sometimes the wisdom and the psychology which Buddhists can sometimes demonstrate is so amazing. They don't have the same responses as people who are doing counselling are trained in and trained to expect. It was not denial, but she'd come very mindful, very aware of it, and decided not to give more ill will towards that situation. So little by little, the practice of the Satipatthana, if it's done properly, has huge amounts of benefits. So many benefits that sometimes even psychology doesn't understand them. How quickly you can let go. And it's also, now I said yesterday about the simile of the falling leaves after a storm, and how it's obvious that some young leaves get torn off and get killed. Same as young people sometimes die. And when they say it's a tragedy, really, is it a tragedy? Or is it just understanding what nature, and nature is sometimes tragic? There's nothing gone wrong. There's no one to blame. Don't blame yourself, don't blame others. And sometimes those attitudes which we get by understanding wisdom in our own mind change the whole response system, and we can be peaceful and get on with our lives. When I'm still surprised when people die, just how people overreact. Death is normal, it's part of life. And for those people who understand and accept, you know, the truth of rebirth, it is a truth. You know, I can stake my life on that. But the point is that when it is accepted, it takes the whole idea of death and gives it another sort of interpretation, another look. If you have an old car, or the car gets in a crash and is unfixable, what do? You get a new one. And especially if you've got good insurance, then you can even get a better model next time. And in that simile, you know, your body is your vehicle in this life. It's not you, it's just the vehicle in which you live for this life. You don't know when it's going to die, but if you've got good insurance, means you make good karma, you're good people. Then it means in your next life you'll probably get a better model, an upgrade. And you don't have to worry about an old body, which is really hard to look after, and very heavy and very slow. So sometimes you look at life and say, oh, you know, my mother died recently, and she's just upgrading her vehicle. And you put it, and it's not a joke, it's like putting it in another way of looking, in a modern simile. So you know that its insight is happening if it solves problems, if it creates more peace and happiness in this world, and in your world too. The sign of insight is peace, freedom, happiness, problems disappearing. If just the sign of insight is more problems, then there's something faulty there. So sometimes you can measure insight by how much peace it gives you. Real big insight leads to a great deal of ease in calming your own mind. You can get peaceful very easily because you understand how the mind works. So that's one of the reasons why that to get that clear insight, we have to first of all just limit those five hindrances. And especially the first one is a big one. And even like sometimes people here will think, oh, maybe Ajahn Brahm, that's a big one. But what about the sloth and torpor, the sleepiness? I'm not sure about you, but when I first started meditating, sloth and torpor was a big problem for me. I always had good karma, so when I was in any meditation retreat, I was never the chief, the top nodder. I was always number two. And so one of the teachers, a member, would interject, say, Gary, you're falling asleep. Oh, sorry. Brahm, you're falling asleep. Oh, yeah. But I was always number two, never number one. So I never caught the worst of it. Same as in that Zen retreat. The Zen retreat where I was looking at the wall and the wall disappeared, which I mentioned to you earlier. That, when the monk went behind you with the stick, the Zen stick, it was the man sitting next to me. He was the one who was more sleepy, so he got hit first. They never needed to hit me. I just heard the sound of it right next to me, and my back was straight. I was scared. So that was not really a good method of keeping you awake. But then, because you had lots of sloth and torpor, you tried all sorts of methods to try to keep awake. And one of those methods in our forest tradition, which was really encouraged for a while, was actually you'd go to a cliff and you sit on the edge of the cliff, not this far back, right on the edge. And the monks who survived said it worked. You get the message. The ones who didn't work, I just never heard from them again. And that was the same with one of the forest monasteries in Laos. This was before the Vietnam War. Because one of the monks I knew, he practiced up there. And what they would do, the teacher, the meditation teacher, would take them on a walk in the jungle. In the mountains up there, mountainous jungle. And almost all day. And just now, when it started getting, maybe an hour before sunset, they come to this clearing in the jungle. And they had some really tall trees there, magnificent trees. And on top of the branches of the trees were these little platforms. And the platforms were about as big as your mat. No bigger, just a mat. Just made out of wood. And there'd be a ladder. And you'd have to walk up that ladder. I never did this, because I couldn't go into Laos, which was fortunate, because I wouldn't have... Maybe you won't see me anymore. But they'd walk up the ladder, climb the ladder, and they sit high up. There's no railings around you. They sit, and the teacher would take the ladder away and say, I'll be back in the morning. And that's what they would do. They'd sit there all night, having walked all day, tired. And there's no way to lie down or do anything. You can either sit and get in some nice meditation or you fall off and die. I say many. That's a bit extreme. But it's also that when you heard those stories, sometimes in some of these in Wat Pa Pong, they didn't have any tall buildings. But when we would sometimes go to town to do our visas, some of the monks tried doing that in Wat Pa. It's a new building, they get on the roof, and they sit right next to the ledge on the roof. And when the abbot saw that, he banned us from going up on the roof. Because, someone will fall off sooner or later. That didn't work to overcome sloth and torpor. Another thing we would do... Oh, I haven't got any matches over there. We get a box of matches. Take off the lid. So you just got the tray with all the matches in it. And you put it on your head when you started meditating. So now, That's a box of matches. Because what happened, if you started falling asleep, you nodded. The box of matches will fall off and make a noise. You'd know it and everyone else would know it. So the embarrassment was supposed to try and help you. And I did that for a couple of days. Fell off many times, but then it didn't fall off. Had a whole hour's meditation. It didn't fall off my head at all. And I thought, yes, I've conquered sloth and torpor. Until someone took me aside and they said, it's not falling off because you're not nodding in the usual way. You're nodding like this. That is how tricky your brain is. So you'd fight many times, sloth and torpor, that hindrance. But then, again, going down to Bangkok to do your visas, the place where we'd go to stay, you know, in Wat Bawon, that they had a new building for visiting monks. It's a wonderful thing about being a monk or being a nun. You know, the Sangha welcomes you everywhere, at least it should do. When we actually build this place, we usually do a very simple ceremony. We dedicate the monasteries to the Sangha of the four quarters, present and yet to come. So it's owned by all of us, by all the monks and the nuns. And they can come in whenever they want, from the past, from the future. And it's a wonderful ideal. It doesn't belong to a tradition. It belongs to the Sangha, the Buddhist tradition. And the Sangha who are resident here, our job is to look after it and care for it, for the Sangha who's going to come in the future. We don't own it. We just care for it. And I thought it was a beautiful, idyllic way, because there's no ownership involved. But we have a responsibility to make sure that, say, Bodhinyana Monastery, Dharmasara Monastery, or the Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project in UK, or Santi, or wherever, that's going to be there for the monks and nuns of the future. I love that idea. But anyway, so we go down there and to do our visas and stay there for a few days. But we found out that they had an air-conditioned lecture room where they would, you know, learn stuff, the intellectual stuff. And so because we'd always get up early in the morning as forest monks, we said, can we use it just, you know, early on before dawn to meditate? I said, oh yeah, why not? So we got the key and we would go into this air-conditioned room early in the morning for a couple of hours of meditation. I just couldn't believe it. I had no sloth and torpor at all. And it was for two or three reasons. The first reason, down there, Ajahn Chah was a long way away. So I could go to bed whenever you want and get up whenever you wanted. I was sleep deprived up in the northeast. You're supposed to only do 4 hours sleep a day. I got about 4.5 hours, 4 hours and 20 minutes, and that's the limit. But down there you can get 5 or 6 hours. And it was comfortable. There's no mosquitoes in your room, so you can get a full night's sleep. And you had decent food. And I've said so much about the really terrible food which you had up in the northeast of Thailand at that time. You know, the frogs and rice and stuff like that, and that's one meal of the day. Sleep deprived, and when you went into that room to meditate, it was air conditioned. It was cool. In the forests of the northeast of Thailand, it was always hot, humid, and just the air was very close. And which meant that you're always sleepy. It was the situation, the air, the food, and the rest wasn't enough. And I realized that was the cause of my sloth and torpor. It wasn't I wasn't putting enough effort in. It was just the situation around you wasn't conducive. And that was very important for me when I, again, built this place. You cannot have the best temperature which fits everybody. That's why you do, you know, have, you've got an air conditioner in here. If it's really hot, you can put it on. You can go into your room. You can go even into your bathroom to meditate, because that's got lots of tiles, and that's much cooler. Maybe even Bodhinyana Monastery once, on one of these hot days in the summer, years and years ago, in my room, which is an A-frame at the time, it was boiling. So I just went down the hill to the toilet block, and I sat in one of the shower rooms there. There wasn't many monks there, and it was nice and cool in there because it had lots of tiles. I was getting into a reasonably deep meditation when somebody used a toilet next to me, and the noise from that was something which I could not ignore and spoiled the whole ambience of the cool, peaceful. Honestly, this is what happens. Oh, crikey. No way I can really get in deep meditation here. You don't know when somebody's going to unload. So, in the end, that didn't work either. But you try to get the best physically for yourself and have a good meal. I always remembered that when the Buddha became enlightened, he started off by having a really good meal. It was a meal which was actually made for a heavenly being. And Sujata saw this monk instead and gave this beautiful meal to Sujata, to the Buddha. And I thought, wow, you know, that you do know if you eat, not so indulgently, but eat a decent meal, you have more energy, you're more happy. And he didn't sit, the Buddha never just sat on the ground. He got some grass, a zafu, to make his body comfortable. He sat under this beautiful tree in a garden. The whole place there was so calm and peaceful and wonderful. And even in some of the instructions, he's saying there's wonderful places where not too many mosquitoes, not too many flies, cool, quiet, the best places to meditate. And when I sort of read that, I thought, wow, we went to so many places that were overly hot for an English monk, just too many, never saw any mosquitoes. Well, I grew up in London. So because of that, you know, it wasn't as conducive. So coming over here, I really wanted to get a place which is conducive for you, comfortable for you. Have chairs for you. You know those chairs you have over there in the back? Sorry, in the back. I went to especial trouble to search many chairs to find the ones which was the best for meditation. And not too comfortable, just the right angle. Not too high, not too low, simple. But, you know, I went to a lot of places until I finally found this place to get those chairs, and also some chairs with the armrests as well. You don't all need armrests, but if you tend to lean over in the meditation, those armrests can protect you. So little by little, you want to make this place comfortable for you. And the reason is because you get much better meditation when you're sitting comfortably. And that's one of the reasons why that probably overcomes sloth and torpor more than anything else. If you overindulge, of course, you get sleepy again. But if you just don't torture yourself, you find what's called the middle path, the middle way, between the extremes of indulgence and the extremes of, we'll actually say the Atta-Gilamata New Yoga means practices which tire and exhaust you. Kilamata. It's exhausting, tiring practices. It's not torture. It's just, after a while, you're exhausted by forcing and trying so hard. And that gives rise to the sloth and torpor. But what I did in those early days, because I didn't really understand the insight into these five hindrances and where they come from and how they're overcome. They're not overcome, they're understood and then they're transcended. I tried to fight my sloth and torpor. I said with the matches on the head, I made my body really straight, right, I am not going to nod. I'm going to stay straight. And I was just watching my body all the time, just, you know, just like a soldier, like a guard in a prison camp. Just one nod from you and your head comes off. It didn't work. Sometimes it would work, but when it did work, my sloth and torpor was replaced by restlessness. I was thinking too much. Then when I slowed down my thoughts, you'd fall asleep again. It was like there was a pendulum. One extreme was sleepiness, the other extreme was restlessness, mostly thinking too much. I could never find that middle point in between. You try and calm down your restlessness and you fall asleep. Try to wake up your restlessness and you start thinking again. And after a while, again reading some of the teachings of the Buddha, you found this wonderful sutta where there was a monk who was sitting perfectly straight, first of all, on the edge of the forest. Sitting perfectly straight on the edge of the forest, wonderful posture. And the Buddha looked at him and turned around to his attendant Ananda and said, "I'm worried about that monk." Soon he disrobed. Perfect posture. And he went into the middle of the forest and saw another monk there who was nodding. And the Buddha smiled. "I'm not worried about him." And a few, I don't know what time later, he became fully enlightened. I thought, hey, this must be an error there somewhere. The guy with the perfect posture, you know, just the Buddha was worried about him and was right, he disrobed. The one who was nodding all over the place, well done. And after a while, of course, you realize what was happening. The one who was a perfect posture was controlling himself. His willpower was very strong. And trying to impress others. That's why he's on the edge of the forest. And it reminded me very much of one of the monks who I grew up with. He was a French monk. And he was almost a perfect monk. You know, when my friends and I would gossip about which monk is doing really, really well, and we thought he was one who'd get enlightened first, if he wasn't already enlightened. When we did our all-night sits on the moon nights, he would never nod at all. He would always be perfectly straight. And he would hardly ever talk. He had few possessions. And we always thought, wow, this is a great monk for the future. And then when I was visiting one monastery somewhere else for a month or so, the word came back that he disrobed. He left the monkhood. And I thought, why? He's so close to enlightenment. And then, of course, when we started talking with him, he said to me, because, you know, he was very close to me, he said, sometimes, he said, "I'd open my eyes, Ajahn Brahm, and I'd see you half asleep when you were meditating. Or maybe not half asleep, maybe 75%, 80%. And he said, "I was so jealous. I wish I could do that. I was so afraid, so controlling myself, so worried what other people would think of me, that I forced myself, you know, to appear like the perfect monk." And he did a good job of that. He did appear like a perfect monk. But he said it was so much stress that after 4 years, I couldn't take it anymore. So I disrobed. And the amount of compassion I had for him was huge. 4 years you enjoy trying to live up to other people's expectations or forcing yourself, and it never worked at all. But when he did disrobe, he gave me his alms bowl. He said, "My alms bowl was just not a very good one." I said, "Take my alms bowl." And that's the alms bowl I have today. And it's about 44 years after he gave it to me. When I have that alms bowl, I always remember him. A monk who taught me just how to let go of sloth and torpor. Not by force, but by wisdom. That is how you overcome these hindrances. So what I did was I was sleepy. I thought, it's obvious, it's of course it's not my fault. I'm an English monk, I like the cold. This was really hot in Asia. In Thailand they had three seasons. The seasons were the hot season, the very hot season, and the hot and wet season. Honestly, there wasn't any cold season. And so I had to adjust to the temperature. And also malnourished. I really was in those days. I showed photos of me. I remember showing, even here, I found one of the old photographs of the first year here. And I showed it to people. Which one of these is me? And they all got it wrong. They couldn't even recognize me. They thought it was another monk. You know, me, I was just so incredibly thin. Malnourished. Overworked. No, I'm not malnourished, but I'm still overworked. So instead of trying to fight sloth and torpor and the tiredness, I decided to understand it and be with it and not fight at all. And that amazing thing happened. You were sleepy and you weren't embarrassed about having your head right down here. And after a while, because I was just mindful, aware of this, and kind, I wasn't going to try and stigmatize sloth and torpor. I was just going to know it as best I could. A little by little, second by second, minute by minute, the head started to lift up by itself. The energy came back. And soon the energy was so good, I could sit straight with really good mindfulness and no restlessness at all. I didn't fight, I understood. And because of that, the sloth and torpor vanished. No, it came back again other days, he didn't have enough sleep or something. But then you understood how to deal with it. Please don't fight these things. Meditation is not a war, it's not a battle. It's won by understanding. You know, they have this this image, or this, oh, what is it called, this metaphor of like Mara. Mara is a thing which is always trying to deceive you, overcome you. It was the symbol of the thing which tried to stop the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree. And it's one of the reasons why we got our city centre in a suburb, No La Mara. Anyone who's Singaporean or Malaysian know that La is what you add to emphasise something. Are you happy, La? So No La Mara means No Mara allowed. But Mara is always the one who tries to get you afraid or scare you, make you do things. And is overcome not by kicking Mara's butt as a US Marine would, but always just through wisdom. I know you, Mara. And then Mara has to slink away. The nun knows me. The monk knows me. It's through wisdom these things are overcome. And I always was just, yes, this is not how I, as a Westerner, was trained. If you want to get something, you've got to go for it. Kick butt. Get rid of all the enemies. You make it yourself. You're going to create a monastery. You fight for it. Was that convincing? I hope it wasn't. But that's not how it works. The kindness, the wisdom, the knowing, that's what makes it successful. And that's how you overcome the hindrances. I know you, sloth and torpor. I know you, restlessness. I know you, wanting. What do you want? One of the little similes is to actually ask you, in your life so far, in all the years you've lived, what are the happiest moments of your life? I mean, really happy moments. You have that, if I asked you to take three moments, which was just so beautiful, so wonderful, what moments were they? If you've had, like, you've won the lottery or something, you suddenly become a billionaire, or you've fallen in love or something, that doesn't actually make it to the best three of your life. The best three of your life is sometimes the most ordinary places. I remember when I asked that question to myself years and years and years ago, I just remember just going a lunch hour, just going to a lake in Kensington Gardens, and just sitting there quietly and feeling so content and happy. And I looked at that time, and there was not anything I would want to change. There's nobody who was missing. I wouldn't like to have anybody else here or get rid of anybody else. It was just a beautiful, peaceful day, and I was content, really content. And those moments when you don't want anyone else to be here, or you don't not want anything, and you're just perfectly at peace. And it was like deep contentment, totally unexpected. And there'll be a few moments like that. You don't need expensive stuff. You don't need this person or that person. You're happy. And after a while I realized that's what we call moments of freedom from wanting. You don't want anything in the whole world. You're just peaceful. Of course, you could improve it. You could get all sorts of other stuff there. But it was so beautiful, I didn't need it. The contentment was really rich and solid. And that's one of the reasons why, even as a young monk, a young man, I realized you don't get such happiness through achieving and satisfying all your wants. You get that happiness by being free from wanting. A wonderful satisfaction of being free from desires. Just for a short time. And of course, that is one of those similes for those who haven't heard it before. What is deep meditation? What is enlightenment? Because those deep meditations, even the first jhana, the Buddha explained it or described it as sambodhisukha. Sambodhi means enlightenment. When I read that, I thought, hey, that must be something wrong. Everyone knows that first jhana isn't enlightenment, but, you know, it's getting close. It's getting in the vicinity, getting in the ballpark. But he actually called it the happiness, what you actually experience when you disappear into a first jhana. It's enlightenment happiness. That's really spooky. That's the sort of stuff which gives you goosebumps. And he said that, you know, simply because it's the happiness of very, very, very deep contentment, close to enlightenment. And the reason it's close to enlightenment, when you understand what enlightenment is. And to do that, when many people would ask me, Ajahn Brahm, what is Nibbana? What is enlightenment? And the best simile, and again, you've all heard this before, but I'm emphasizing it now. The best simile is the five children playing the wishing game. If you had a wish, what would it be? The kid who comes up with the best wish would win the wishing game. First kid, a new computer game. Second kid said, no, that's not going to work because after 6 months or something, you know, there'll be a new game come out. So if I had a wish, I'd wish for my own computer game shop. If I own it, when a new one comes out, I can get it. The third kid said, no, that doesn't work either. Even though I can have access to as many computer games as I want, my mum will never let me have the time. I've got to do my homework first. And so the third kid said, I wish for $1 billion, US. With $1 billion, I'd buy my own computer game shop. And then I'd buy my own school. If I own a school and I'm the one who pays the headmaster and all the teachers, they can't write letters to my mum saying my grades are going down. They can't sort of say that I need to work harder. If I own a school, I don't need to go there. And after I graduate from the own school I own, you know, they do have honorary degrees and stuff. I can buy my own university, give myself an honorary degree. So I don't need to do any work at all. I can spend all the day doing computer games, what I like. And if my mum and dad finds out, or if, you know, the government has all these laws, I suppose, I'd fund, give donations to this political party. So my political party, the free computer games without having need to go to school party. So that way I can find ways of just enjoying myself. So that would be my wish. $1 billion. And the fourth kid said, no, I could do better than that. Fourth kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have $1 billion. My second wish, I'd have... What was it? What's the second wish? My first wish, I'd have my computer game store, franchise, many stores. My second wish, I'd have $1 billion. And the third wish, I'd have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. And it's actually a very beautiful simile, this, because, you know, it's a little story which people can understand, and it lets you understand about what happiness is and what enlightenment is. And so that was a fourth wish, an infinity of wishes, always granted. And the fifth kid beat that very easily. If I had a wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. That's nibbana, enlightenment. You're so content, you don't need wishes. The freedom from desire. The fourth kid had the freedom of desire. Whatever you want, you can get it. That's not a happiness at all. That's power, but not happiness. And you can see how that works in life. So many rich people, well, it could be like a Morrison or a Trump. They're very rich already. And sometimes, why do they want to go into politics? They don't need to do anything. They can retire with all that money they have somewhere or other. But anyway, it doesn't matter how many billions of dollars you haven't got the power to get all your wishes given as soon as you want them. That's why they go from being wealthy to being in power. From wealth to power, and then after power, you realize that that's not going to give you happiness either. So much so that what is it that... When I used to go to the airports and sit around there and used to talk to people, and this Muslim fellow came up to me once, and he's from the Middle East, and he told me, he just said, the worst curses in the Middle East... And the number 2 worst thing you can say to somebody in the Middle East was, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. It's a bad, nasty wish, but it was funny. May the fleas of 1,000 armpits infest... No, the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. But then the worst one of all, was, may you get everything you wish for as soon as you wish it. That was a curse. That's why I remember those two. When I heard that second one, I thought, wow, that is really profound. Whatever you wish for, may you get it straight away. Then you understand just what suffering is, what happiness is, and why wishing for things is never going to give you any happiness. It's even why that we have this idea, it's totally just not said by the Buddha, of the pure land, where supposedly Amitabha lives. Whatever you want, you get it straight away. That must be so much suffering. But anyway, the greatest of the happinesses is being the freedom from desire. You don't need desire anymore. You're not in its control. Sometimes we think that wanting is our choice. We desire to do it. We're free to want or not want. Are you? Imagine you really are free from wanting. How beautiful that is. There was this time, I was a young monk over in Thailand. And as a young monk, even then, people ask you some help, some problem solving, and sometimes you give a bit of advice, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But for this man, it really worked for him. He said, "Oh, thank you so much, that was brilliant advice. I want to sort of say thank you to you." And they cannot give monks money, because we keep the Vinaya very strictly. So, we don't accept any money. But what he did do is a loophole. Sometimes I like loopholes, being a bit rebellious, but the loophole was, you can't give the monk money, or the nun money, but what you can do is say, "I have $100 for you, I want to give you. And I'll give it to, say, Ananda, he will look after it for me. Anything you need for $100, you just let Ananda know and he'll get it for you." And that's the, they call it mendicant allowance. So this is what the guy did. He said, "Look, I want to give you, not $100, 100 baht. There's villagers. They really helped me. 100 baht, what do you need for 100 baht? And I was, "No, I'll keep the money for you," he said. "I'll come tomorrow, you let me know." I was okay. So I went back to my hut that evening, and just after the evening meeting, and thought, "What do I need?" I had 100 baht to spend. I said, "Well, 100 baht, how much is that worth? That's about $3 or something, isn't it?" In those days. Anyway, not that much, but it was, for a mug, I had nothing. That was a lot. So I lit a candle, and straight away I said, "Look, candles are bad for the eyes. And if that's all you look at, you wipe by." So I said, "I want one of these little lanterns, with the oil." And he said, "Not just a lantern, because even I was writing with a pencil. That's not really nice to write with. Like just an ordinary biro pen, it's a ballpoint pen, not an expensive thing, but just an ordinary pen." That was my number two on the list. And I was actually writing this out on the back of a mosquito repellent coil on the wrapping, because I didn't have any paper. So I said, "Just an ordinary exercise book." And then I said, "What I'm writing, actually, I need to write some aerograms to my mum in UK." So I asked her some aerograms. And then I looked, and even those four things, I added it up, there was much more than 100 baht. And I thought, which one should I take off? And as I was thinking which one I had to take off, I thought, actually, when you talk about light, I need a new flashlight and some batteries as well. And when you're walking, this is really dangerous. There's snakes in those jungle paths in Thailand. I don't just need a flashlight. I need some proper sandals. My old sandals, they were just taped together, and they were just amazing. They lasted so long, so I need some proper sandals. And then 1,000 baht was not enough. Before that time, I was perfectly happy and content. Now, this is a true story. Now I had 100 baht to spend. It was never enough. Fortunately, I could understand what was happening. And I had that piece of paper, I screwed it up and I threw it in the waste bin, the spittoon. And when he came the next day, I said, "Well, what do you want for 100 baht?" I said, "Don't you ever do that to me again. Never." I was so happy having nothing, so content I was. But now you give me all this money, crikey, it's only 100 baht. That's why I really sympathize with each one of you. I don't know how much you've got in your bank account. I sympathize with you. Poor things. Because it opens the doorway to craving and wanting. We don't have anything. You've got nothing to crave for. So that freedom from desire is so wonderful, so peaceful. And that's one of the reasons why, when you understand what desire is, wanting, you understand its opposite. You understand how to overcome the hindrances. It's why we build this place like it is. What do you want here? You got water in the tap. You got food coming in a short while. You got tea, coffee, juices, whatever you want. You got a nice room. There's no rent to pay. Nothing to do. Do a little bit of cleaning when you want to. Everything is for free. You don't have to put money in the slot to wash your clothes or to go to the toilet. Nothing is money orientated here. It's peace orientated. Freedom from desires. Not the freedom of desires. Can you touch that and taste that, what it's like? See, he don't want anything in the whole world. It comes, it doesn't come. Perfectly at ease, no matter what happens. That freedom from desires, overcoming that first hindrance. Oh, that's so wonderful. It's a freedom which, that's what desire is supposed to do anyway. That's what it promises you. You get this and then you'll be happy. Like I said the other day, pass this exam and then you get happy. Get your house, then you'll be happy. Get your car, get your investments, get your superannuation, get your... I never finished that simile, but the end of that simile was really funny when I wrote it down. You know, you go and get married, you find someone to share your life with. Oh, when we get married, then I'll be happy. It was actually true that this one girl, and I did her marriage blessing, and she came up to me just afterwards, maybe 15 minutes afterwards. Her husband was, you know, not there at this, you know, little, just to speak to me. And she said, Ajahn Brahm, people tell me that the day you get married is the happiest day of your life. If that's true, I'm in big trouble. Is this it? I said, no, it's not the happiest day of your life. Oh, thank you. But then you think, just when you retire, because when people come to monasteries like this, they're mostly retired or getting close to retire. When I retire, then I'll be happy. What do you do when you retire? Then you volunteer to be secretary of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. You don't retire. We don't leave you alone. He's our secretary next year after the AGM. Oh, AGM's only a week or two away, isn't it? Yeah, you've only got a couple of weeks of freedom. Please make the best use of it. And then what we think. We think, okay, yeah, you have to work and it's always a struggle. But when I die, then I'll be free. Rest in peace. If you know there's reincarnation, you don't rest in peace. You ask any ghost, are you resting in peace yet? Nope. So little by little, I always thought this when I was young. Why do you have to die before you can rest in peace? Can't you rest in peace now? You can. So that's why, if you want to put a sign on the door of your room in your cottage, put there R.I.P. me. Rest in peace. Why not? You're resting. You're not going anywhere trying to achieve anything, trying to get anything. You don't need anything. You have this beautiful peace. The people think you're weird and you're strange, but actually you're very wise to rest in peace while you're still alive. It's called meditation. So little by little, we understand that hindrance of wanting, hindrance of ill will. It doesn't do anything to anybody. I like the term ill will, because will is ill. If you want something, you're sick. If you don't want anything, your mind is free and healthy, just happy. So anyway, those are sort of the hindrances. And I was going cracking, 9 o'clock already. That's what I said at the beginning over there, when you really get peaceful, this time has no meaning for you. Until you look at the clock. But anyway, so those hindrances, where they actually are overcome is what you do even before the Satipatthana. The other factors are just the right view. First factor. Second factor of right motivation. To renounce. To be kind, to be gentle. The three right motivations, Sammasankappa. And all the precepts you do, the right speech, action, livelihood. You do the livelihood not to stimulate yourself, but to have simplicity, harmlessness. Realize how much do you need? As a monk, you know, as a nun, we can set that example. You know, you are apparently going to go into my cave in a day or two's time, is that correct?
Tomorrow,
excellent. I'm not going to tidy it up. As you see it, that's how it is. And because that's where I spend a lot of my time. And please, Nicholas, don't tidy it up for me. Just leave it as it is, please. Because sometimes he goes in there and tidies up. Well, even worse than that, I remember when Burr was around. Burr is a really wonderful woman, but when we were trying to raise funds for something or other, they get some stuff from my cave. And so I remember just going in there once, and I didn't know she'd been in there just taking stuff for some auction for something or other. And then, hey, where's my blanket gone? This is not my cushion. That's all for a good cause, I didn't mind. But keeping it simple, it's just so freeing. Still remember even when I was not staying in the cave yet, in one of the huts I was staying in. And then some people came for visits, just some group, how do monks live? And I took them inside my hut and they came out after and said, wow, is this actually where you live? See, this is it. It's all my worldly possessions are in here. They said, wow, I wish I lived in a place like this, that I get all my housework done in 10 minutes. Instead of all the housework you have to do in big houses, crikey. So keep it small, keep it simple. Have a few possessions. And that helps you weaken your hindrances. It's called restraint. And don't think you have to get these things. You have to get the most modern of this and the most modern of that. The old one you have is sometimes the best. Even old cars. Old cars are really good because you can leave them unlocked and nobody steals them. No self-respecting burglar will be seen trying to break into a car like yours. I still don't remember it happened to us. We had this old vehicle. It wasn't that old, but it was old enough. And one of the Anagarikas, you know, doing something in town, so he said, this is a really nice place to get some lunch, Ajahn Brahm. And so we went into this cafe and he brought me some lunch in there. And then when we were just finishing, he couldn't find the car keys. He said, I've lost the car keys. And we looked sort of everywhere and they weren't on the floor. And I looked across the road. It was in Newcastle Street, you know, in Northbridge. And it's a very sort of dangerous place. We looked across the street. We'd been in the restaurant for about half an hour chatting away. And then we looked in the car and I said, hey, the doors are open. The engine is running, the keys are in the lock, in the car, you know, in the ignition. He left the car unlocked, Car, the keys in the ignition and the engine going for half an hour in Northbridge, Newcastle Street. It didn't really matter because it was an old car. So that's the best security system for you. Get an old car. Anyway, I could talk too long. Anyway, thank you for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Hee hee hee.